Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 265. It's July 15th, and I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, let's get started first up with a very interesting story from Harm Reduction, Ohio, about fentanyl and overdoses. Overdose deaths fall to 9-year low in Ohio as fentanyl's presence in drugs ebbs. Overdose deaths in Ohio have fallen to their lowest level since 2015, continuing a historic drop that began unexpectedly last September. The significant decline appears linked to a June 2023 decision by a major branch of the Sinaloa cartel to stop producing and shipping fentanyl or fentanyl analogs. The sharp reduction in fentanyl in Ohio's drug supply is evident in recent state crime lab tests on illicit drugs seized by law enforcement. 4/5 of Ohio overdose deaths involve fentanyl. Harm Reduction Ohio was the first to report the steep decline in both overall overdose deaths and fentanyl in Ohio. Since then, the trend of reduced deaths and safer drug supply in Ohio has accelerated. The size and swiftness of the drop in overdose deaths are unprecedented. Ohio has gone from suffering 400 overdose deaths per month to fewer than 300 per month. Ohio recorded a record high of 574 overdose deaths in May of 2020. The estimated toll in both January and February of this year is less than half that. The approximately 260 overdose deaths that occurred in February is the lowest number recorded since October 2015, when 250 residents died from drug overdoses. The favorable trend in overdose deaths is bittersweet. Even with a 1/3 reduction, Ohio's overdose death rate remains horrifically high and far above anything experienced before the crackdown on OxyContin access began. The attack on OxyContin availability pushed opioid users to more dangerous black market drugs. First heroin, then illicitly manufactured fentanyl. That caused overdose deaths to double. Fentanyl then spread from opioids into stimulants and other drugs, doubling deaths again. The closing of borders during the COVID-19 response caused fentanyl, a compact, easy-to-smuggle drug, to displace bulkier, safer drugs like cocaine. That market disruption sent overdose deaths among people who used drugs to record highs in 2020 and 2021. Cocaine and meth users now account for half of fentanyl-related overdose deaths. Even with that caveat, the decline in overdose deaths is profoundly good news. Ohio's overdose death rate has fallen to not just pre-COVID levels, but to the lowest level since before carfentanil drove a massive overdose surge in 2016 and 17, and before fentanyl infiltrated Ohio's cocaine and meth supply starting in 2018. What happened to make Ohio's drug supply safer? In June 2023, the Sinaloa cartel branch run by the family of Joaquin Guzman, El Chapo, quit the fentanyl business. The family enforced its prohibition on fentanyl within its region it controlled by announcing the policy on banners hung on bridges and killing more than 50 local cooks and middlemen who failed to comply. Today, compliance around the city of Culiacan, the capital of the state of Sinaloa, is near 100%. The cartel-imposed prohibition of fentanyl has had a positive effect on Ohio. Drugs in Ohio are purer, less adulterated, and less deadly than they've been in many years. Unadulterated cocaine, in particular, is more plentiful in Ohio today than it has been in over a decade. Fentanyl and fake Xanax pills is rarer than at any time since COVID-19 pushed drug markets towards fentanyl. Why did El Chapo's family abandon fentanyl? The reason behind El Chapo's family decision to quit the fentanyl business are not well understood. Cartel watchers speculated that the move was made to reduce law enforcement pressure and support negotiations with the Mexican and possibly the U.S. governments. El Chapo, the patriarch, is now held in a supermax federal prison, and one of the four sons who now control the family business was extradited to the United States last year. Cartel experts also note that fentanyl is not as profitable as it once was. Extortion and immigrant smuggling are more lucrative for crime families today than fentanyl. Regardless of motivation, the family's decision to stop shipping fentanyl has dramatically reduced the volume of fentanyl found in Ohio. Many other Sinaloa cartel branches continue to produce and export fentanyl, but El Chapo's organization was the most significant fentanyl producer. It is believed to have been the first big entrant into the fentanyl business a decade ago, and the biggest producer and exporter until its sudden market exit. Fentanyl's presence in Ohio. Harm Reduction Ohio measures fentanyl's presence in Ohio by analyzing state crime lab data. Since 2008, the Ohio Bureau of Criminal Investigation crime labs have conducted more than 500,000 gas chromatography mass spectrometry tests on drug samples seized by law enforcement statewide. Academic research has shown that frequency of fentanyl in the Bureau of Criminal Investigation crime lab data is highly correlated with overdose deaths reported in Ohio Health Department mortality data. The key findings from the crime lab data: fentanyl found in just 20% of all drugs in the 3 months ending in June 2024, down from 27% in the 3 months ending June 2023, and a peak of 29% in the 3 months ending July 2020. Only fentanyl, drugs containing only fentanyl and no other controlled substances, fell to 6% in the 3 months ending June 2024, down from almost 11% in the 3 months ending in June 2023, and a peak of 14% in the 3 months ending in July 2020. Cocaine adulterated with fentanyl. The share of cocaine mixed with fentanyl fell to under 12% in the 3 months ending in June 2024, down from almost 20% in the 3 months ending in June 2023. Cocaine unadulterated. Pure cocaine that is mixed with no other controlled substances made up 24% of Ohio's drug supply in the 3 months ending in June 2024. That was a significant increase from unadulterated cocaine making up 15% of the drug supply in the 3 months ending June of last year, and just 7% in the 3 months ending in September 2020. Not since 2011 has cocaine been as plentiful and pure in Ohio as in recent months. Strangely, that's good news. Methamphetamine. Meth's presence in Ohio's drug supply has remained stable, a little over 40% over the last year. The share of meth containing fentanyl also remains stable at about 5%. Xanax. Only 2% of seized Xanax contained fentanyl in the 3 months ending in June 2024, down from 10% in the 3 months ending in June of last year, and more than 40% in the 3 months ending in 2021. It's unclear why unadulterated cocaine has become more common, but unadulterated meth has not. A likely cause is different supply routes and countries of origins for the two drugs. What does all this mean? Ohio residents are consuming safer, purer, less fentanyl-adulterated drugs than any time in nearly a decade. The result has been about 100 to 125 fewer residents dying from overdoses every month. Is this change sustainable? Will the decline in overdose deaths increase or decrease in the rest of 2024? Will other cartel branches replace the diminished fentanyl supply? Will El Chapo's cartel branch resume fentanyl production as quickly as it stopped? The overdose epidemic is out of our hands and in the hands of organized crime families in Mexico. Crime families control criminalized markets. That's how market economies work. Today, the lives of thousands of Ohioans and tens of thousands of Americans depend on behind-the-scenes management decisions made by a couple dozen cartel organizations in Mexico. The drug war is a catastrophic, multi-generational policy blunder. The consequences of this policy mistake, however unintended, are on full display right now in Ohio. What happens next? It's out of our control. We can only watch and count the bodies. So the tie-in with criminalization, which the drug war, you know, amped up, you know, interdiction and trying to, you know, criminalize drug use and all this type of thing, that you know, made it so profitable for criminal organizations to get involved in the drug trade. And of course, then they get the decisions rather than regular businesses, not criminal cartels. Okay, well, addiction in America is much more complicated than that. It's just not the supply of drugs. This from Scientific American. We're not asking the right question to solve the overdose crisis. Why do people use drugs? It's one of those neglected questions with answers right in front of our noses. We just refuse to look. Getting high and overdosing is, after all, as American as apple pie. Over 46 million people in the U.S. have an alcohol or drug use disorder. Everyone knows someone who died or has lost a son or daughter, mother or father, to a drug overdose, one of the 100,000 plus now yearly recorded nationwide. It's no coincidence that drug overdose deaths have been rising exponentially in America since the 1980s. That's when more and more of life's vital necessities, from housing to healthcare and education, were left to the whims of the marketplace. Corporations squeeze more and more profit at the expense of consumer protection and public safety. Ever since the American economy deindustrialized, the gap in wealth and education inequality, along with measures of well-being like life expectancy, grew wider. Economic and social conditions like what we're living through fuel a sense that people are being screwed over, resulting in rampant distrust of American institutions, breeding loneliness and despair, and thus an urge to escape. The pain is felt ever sharper when systematic failures are internalized as personal ones. People who lose control of their substance use have long been deemed constitutionally weak-willed, doomed to a life of moral turpitude. That dim view of human compulsion, thankfully, has shifted in recent decades. During the 1990s, decade of the brain, addiction came to be viewed through a neurobiological framework that promised to unleash the power of neuroscience and technology on the mysteries of brain disorders, unlocking new treatments. Well, a lack of scientific knowledge or clinical skills is not to blame. Instead, it's our Kafkaesque health system, littered with holes, gaps, and silos, that is incapable of administering the best treatment science has to offer. People struggling with addiction are repeatedly failed by the institutions meant to help them. Arresting, prosecuting, and incarcerating people struggling with addiction has become incredibly unpopular and widely seen across the political spectrum as a costly failure. And yet attempts to decriminalize drugs and create robust systems of healthcare and social services triggers ferocious backlash. The policy pendulum swings between liberalizing and relaxing drug laws to more aggressive and harsh enforcement. Caught in the middle is a well-meaning, albeit quixotic, techno-optimism seeking impractical moonshots like a fentanyl vaccine and brain-stimulating implants. Reading about the lives of people using meth in rural Alabama, I couldn't help but think about the other end of the addiction spectrum. Studies repeatedly find that recovery rates among doctors, airline pilots, and other professionals are much, much higher than the general population. Some attribute their success to the intensity of the treatment, long-term strict monitoring, and frequent drug tests. But there's another crucial element at work. These well-paid professionals have something to lose, and therefore something to live for. More than their future livelihood is on the line, their identity, entire life's work is contingent on their recovery. So long as our drug policies fixate on treating symptoms, the downstream manifestation of an economy, society, and culture that has left so many behind, then the actual disease will go untreated. So again, a good accounting of the social factors that drive addiction. And of course, it's been said that the opposite of addiction is connection, and we live in the most disconnected, socially isolated culture in human history. Okay, well, next up, let's switch gears and talk about the second leading cause of death in America, which is cancer. This from The Hill. Cancer cases in U.S. linked to modifiable risk factors. 4 in 10 cancer cases and about half of cancer deaths among U.S. adults 30 years and older in 2019 were linked to modifiable risk factors like smoking, drinking, poor diet, and not getting vaccinated, according to a new study from the American Cancer Society. Cigarette smoking was the most common behavioral risk factor, contributing to 20% of all cancer cases and 30% of all cancer deaths. Despite considerable declines in smoking prevalence during the past few decades, the number of lung cancer deaths attributable to cigarette smoking in the United States is still alarming. Being overweight was the second most common modifiable risk factor, contributing to almost 8% of cancer cases and about 7% of deaths, followed by drinking alcohol, which was linked to over 5% of cancer cases and about 4% of cancer deaths. When it comes to specific cancer type, one modifiable risk factor, an HPV infection, contributed to 100% of cervical cancer cases and deaths in the U.S. The best way adults can protect themselves from cancers caused by an HPV infection is to get vaccinated against the virus. But HPV vaccination rates in the U.S. have stagnated at around 47% since 2019. Other cancers that had high associations with modifiable risk factors were skin cancer, anal cancer, larynx, lung, and oral cancer. More than 92% of anal cancer cases were linked to a modifiable risk factor, like an infection, HPV. 94% of larynx cancer and nearly 90% of lung cancer cases were also linked to a modifiable risk factor, according to the study. Of course, lung cancer linked to smoking and larynx cancer linked to both smoking and drinking. And actually, this study is kind of on the low end of kind of attributable risk factors to so-called modifiable factors. You notice there wasn't a lot of talk about diet other than alcohol, if you include that as part of your diet, and higher estimates when you get into dietary factors are even higher than the 50% of deaths related to modifiable risk factors. Okay, well, let's switch to some healthcare stories. So in the healthcare system, primary care is really the anchor for prevention, as much as it's known in our healthcare system, pretty much. In this story from Medical Express, the U.S. primary care system can't withstand the next pandemic, some believe. Fighting off the next pandemic will require lawmakers to set priorities. A good place to start would be the nation's long underfunded and often overlooked primary care sector. Primary care is often a patient's first point of contact with the health system. It includes preventative measures such as blood pressure and cancer screenings, treating common illnesses, and managing chronic diseases. Decades of research show that regular access to primary care improves a patient's overall health. Early primary care interventions also save money. The average cost of a trip to the emergency room is 16 times higher than a visit to the doctor. Health officials in Oregon determined that a 1% increase in primary care spending was associated with a 13% of savings for other services, including emergency department, inpatient, and specialty care. Now, there's a deal for you, a $13 return. If only we ran healthcare like a business, a social business for social good, the common good. Primary care workers were vital during the pandemic. As COVID spread, they administered tests and vaccines, and they encouraged masking and social distancing. Many practices embraced telehealth innovations, expanding access to millions of patients, including in rural and underserved areas. Yet the outbreak took a toll. The deluge of life-threatening, chaotic, and often thankless work drove doctors and nurses to quit in droves. Many primary care practices shuttered or dramatically reduced services as patients stayed home. Foregone primary care treatments, from vaccinations to routine cancer screenings, may have caused thousands of avoidable deaths. Funding from Congress helped stabilize struggling practices, yet the U.S. still invests far less in primary care as a percentage of health spending than other rich nations, even as the demands of an aging population grow. Per capita costs remain among the highest in the world, driven by expensive, often unnecessary procedures with some of the worst health outcomes. The primary care workforce has also been slow to recover, largely thanks to recruitment challenges that predate the pandemic. Lower reimbursement and rates, and therefore salaries, relative to specialties such as dermatology and orthopedics, have long steered many medical school graduates away from primary care. The industry expects a shortage of up to 40,000 primary care doctors by 2036. Already, a third of Americans don't have one. The U.S. needs to narrow these gaps before the next pandemic. For starters, Congress should extend common-sense telehealth provisions that are set to expire, including allowing Medicare beneficiaries to receive such services in their homes. It should also support programs like Baltimore's door-to-door nursing pilot that encourage more people to seek primary care. Finally, it should pass bipartisan legislation that aims to rebuild the workforce, including through targeted loan forgiveness for primary care doctors and funding for nurse training. A stronger primary care system won't prevent the next pandemic, but strengthening the nation's frontline defenses will save money and lives and help keep strange outbreaks at bay. Okay, I'm going to switch gears a little bit and look at a very specific part of our healthcare system. That's pediatric gender-affirming care. This is from MedPage Today. The CAS report, evidence, and ethical thinking on pediatric gender-affirming care. The U.S. CAS report has spurred many headlines, most of which tout the findings of, quote, weak evidence for gender-affirming care. What, quote, weak and, quote, strong mean in the context of systematic reviews is a bit more nuanced than how it is portrayed in the media. We have previously written about the U.S. implications of CAS. Here we expand on the ethical considerations of pediatric gender-affirming care and emphasize that a careful reading of CAS makes it clear that the report does not support bans, but rather an improved model of care. So this is actually a really good long read if you're interested in this issue, and is a particularly good study in kind of how to use scientific information to generate clinical decision making. Now, of course, not supporting bans is one thing, but improving a model of care is another. It can be very difficult to change healthcare systems, and you can have a good model that doesn't necessarily get implemented in the real world. But and gender-affirming care is something that takes a rather comprehensive interdisciplinary medical intervention. So when that's done, it's a lot more justified. But as these researchers point out, even the relatively more, quote, conservative CAST report, which is citing weaker evidence in the pantheon of science, that actually a careful read does not actually support bans, but rather an improved model of care. And next up on the topic of gender-affirming surgery, this is a fascinating story from Medical Express, examining rates of gender-affirming surgery in the U.S. For adults and minors, most breast reductions performed on cisgender males and transgender and gender-diverse people are performed on cisgender males, according to a research letter published in JAMA Network Open. Overall, 60% and 96% of gender-affirming surgical procedures identified among adults and minors were chest-related procedures. So that's 60% of adults and 96% of minors were chest-related procedures. 80% of the breast reductions among cisgender male and transgender adults were performed on cisgender males. 97% of the breast reductions among cisgender male minors and transgender diverse male minors were performed on cisgender male minors. So this is a fascinating thing. You were so focused on transgender and gender diverse issues that we're overlooking the fact that cisgender folks, cisgender men, are getting breast reductions. You know, if you're very much overweight and you have, large breasts as a man, a lot of men are actually seeking breast reduction, not because of their gender identity per se, like they want to switch their gender identity. They just don't, they feel that it's necessary for them to have a breast reduction surgery. So that's way more common in cisgender males than in transgender and gender diverse males. Wow. A good example of how the focus on one particular issue or one particular population can really be distorted when put in proper context. Okay, well, next up, we're going to go to some really basic data in public health, and that would be population. This from the Hill. World population is projected to grow from 8.2 billion to a peak of 10.3 billion in the 2080s, the United Nations says. The world's population is expected to grow by more than 2 billion people in the next decades and peak in the 2080s at around 10.3 billion, a major shift from a decade ago, a new report by the United Nations said. John Wilmoth, head of the UN Population Division, which prepared the report, said the probability that the world's population will peak within the current century is quite high, around 80%. This is a major change compared to the United Nations projections from a decade earlier, when the estimated probability of the global population would reach a maximum, and thus the growth would come to an end during the 21st century. It was around 30%, he said. According to World Population Prospects 2024 report, the earlier than anticipated population peak is due to several factors, including lower fertility levels in some of the world's largest countries, especially China, whose population is projected to drop dramatically from 1.4 billion this year to 633 million in 2100. Globally, women are having an average of one fewer child than they did in 1990, the report said, and in more than half of all countries and territories, the average number of live births per woman is below 2.1. That's the level needed for a country's population to maintain its size without migration. While these differences are striking, Wilmoth said, it's important to understand that all populations are following a similar path. The differences stem from countries being at different stages of the demographic transition towards longer lives and smaller families. Wilmoth cited additional key findings in the report. Following the COVID-19 pandemic, global life expectancy is rising again. By 2080, people aged 65 and older will outnumber children under 18 years of age. In some countries, immigration will be the main driver of future growth. and gender equality and women's empowerment can help counter population growth. That cannot be understated, that the status of women and a more positive status, healthful status of women, actually counters population growth when women are given other alternatives than having a lot of kids for Social Security and such. The world's population has grown dramatically in the last 75 years, from an estimated 2.6 billion in 1950 to 8 billion in November 2022. Kathleen Mogulgaard, president and CEO of the Washington-based Population Institute, said the new estimates underscore an increasing demographic divide around the world. While it identified more than 100 countries and territories whose populations have already peaked or will do so in the next 30 years, she said, it shows even more where population will keep growing, many of them among the world's poorest nations. The UN said rapid population growth is likely to magnify the scale of investments and efforts required to eradicate poverty and hunger, ensure universal health care and education in countries facing severe economic, social, and environmental challenges. Conversely, countries where fertility is low that face rapid population declines may require innovative policies to deal with labor market, social protection, and national security ramifications. So, of course, the big uncertainty over all of this is we have a lot of existential crises that could emerge. Climate change in and of itself could be that, but probably the notion of polycrises, several things coming together, and perhaps even ending civilization as we know it, is one possibility that could lead to large human population declines and would kind of obviate virtually all of this article. So that's an uncertainty. But clearly, if populations start going down, it really does challenge the notion of continued economic, forever cancerous kind of economic growth. And it gives us an opportunity to look at kind of degrowth, circular economies, these type of things that can actually set up a more sustainable future for humans on this planet. And of course, while Main Street is trying to eke out a living, Wall Street is up to its usual shenanigans. This from the Environmental Health Network. Wall Street profits from asbestos liabilities at victims' expense. Private equity firms are quietly acquiring asbestos liability claims, leaving victims to suffer as Wall Street profits from delaying or denying compensation. Private equity firms are buying companies' asbestos liabilities, allowing them to manage large pools of cash with minimal oversight. By delaying or denying asbestos-related claims, these firms turn a profit from the interest accrued on the cash reserves. Legal tactics like this Texas two-step may help these firms avoid paying future claims, leaving asbestos victims without recourse. The companies that expose people to asbestos are finding ways to evade having to pay for the harms that they have caused down the road. And why this matters? Financial firms, driven by profit rather than justice, are snapping up claims at a discount, betting on turning a hefty profit. But this financial maneuvering threatens to complicate and lengthen the already arduous process for victims seeking redress. And sort of another variation on just declaring bankruptcy and expunging the liability completely. You can always figure that the money changers are going to figure out a way to make money off people's misery. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And next up, we have a fascinating story that's a good example how you can have a good government program that's being profiteered off by companies that aren't particularly interesting in meeting the mission of those programs. This from Stat News. Medicaid is paying millions for salty, fat-laden, medically tailored cheeseburgers and sandwiches. They're marketed as healthy, quote, dietitian-approved meals and delivered directly to the homes of people seriously ill from cancer, diabetes, or heart disease. A Jimmy Dean frozen sausage breakfast sandwich, biscuits and gravy, a cheeseburger. These are among the offerings sold by an Idaho-based company, Homestyle Direct, which is paid millions of dollars each year by taxpayer-funded state Medicaid programs to deliver what the company calls medically tailored meals. The company, which advertises delivering 7.8 million meals annually, has menus catering to customers trying to manage their cancer and diabetes, as well as, quote, heart-healthy and, quote, renal-friendly dishes. However, multiple nutrition experts told Stat that many of Homestyles Direct's offerings fall far short of what they'd consider medically tailored meals, a class of foods that have been proven to help those suffering from diet-related conditions improve their health and stay out of the hospital. Most also don't appear to meet new voluntary accreditation standards crafted by medically tailored meal providers. Homestyle Direct to me doesn't look like medically tailored meals at all. It doesn't even look like generally healthy meals, said Darius Mozafari, and director of the Food as Medicine Institute at Tufts University. The company's ability to bill Medicaid for meals loaded with sodium and saturated fat, some of which could be bought in the grocery store at much lower costs, raises questions about federal and state oversight of meal delivery programs for people mostly confined to their homes, which are operated under a provision in the Medicaid program known as Home and Community-Based Services Waiver. While there's no universally accepted definition for a medically tailored meal, most nutrition experts say they should be low in certain ingredients, like sodium, added sugar, and saturated fat, and high in fiber, others, like fiber. Many also expect these meals to be free of the additives like preservatives and stabilizers that typically lace unhealthy processed foods. Homestyle Direct's Jimmy Dean breakfast sandwich, offered as part of his diabetes menu, boasts 980 milligrams of sodium. The company's cancer support and diabetes-friendly biscuits and gravy sausage has more than half the sodium and saturated fat that experts recommend healthy adults consume in a single day. And his cheeseburger has roughly 50 ingredients, a telltale sign of so-called ultra-processed food. The cheeseburger is advertised as helping customers with cancer, diabetes, renal issues, and heart problems, despite the fact that consumption of ultra-processed foods has been associated with type 2 diabetes, heart disease-related mortality, and certain forms of cancer. Homestyle Direct is just one of the for-profit companies that bill Medicaid programs for home-delivered meals. Magic Kitchen sells its own version of biscuits and gravy, with 1,110 milligrams of sodium and 12 grams of saturated fat. Another company, Mom's Meals, sells a cheeseburger soup with pretzel bits, oatmeal cream pie, and milk that together has 930 milligrams of sodium and 12 grams of added sugar. Jeff Bartow, CEO of Homestyle Direct, said the company follows state rules governing meals' nutritional content and that the company strives to, quote, balance nutritional guidelines with palatability and cultural preferences. The CEO of Magic Kitchen, Greg Miller, similarly said his company tries to, quote, cater to as many different types of diets and cultures that we can, adding that the biscuits and gravy had been requested by several customers. That meal's sodium content is higher than the majority of his company's meals, he said, and is not meant for people on a sodium-restricted diet. Teresa Roof, a public relations manager for Mom's Meals, said the company actually increased the calories and nutrients of his cheeseburger soup meal through offering sides so it could meet certain Medicaid nutritional guidelines. Sides help us ensure that we're providing enough calories and nutrients to sustain overall nutrition, Roof said. Healthy eating is all about balance. States set their own rules for Medicaid meal programs, and they often set very loose restrictions governing the nutritional content of the food. The state stat queried only required that the meal sent to patients provide at least one-third of the nutrients that a person is supposed to consume in a day, which is known as a dietary reference intake. It's a place where we have lacked standards for more nutritionally sound food, said Rachel Landauer, a clinical instructor at the Center for Health Law and Policy Innovation at Harvard Law School. She noted that these meal services were originally conceived to help people who might have difficulty leaving their home access food rather than deliver meals meant to improve nutrition. Advocates fear that companies like Homestyle Direct are attempting to take advantage of the growing food as medicine movement, which aims to better integrate healthy food in traditional healthcare. Medically tailored meals have been primarily offered by nonprofit, community-based organizations since the services began in the 1980s to provide healthy meals to people dying of AIDS. That has begun to change, however, as food as medicine has become vogue in Washington, gaining the backing of the Biden White House, as well as national organizations like the American Heart Association and the Rockefeller Foundation. There are many companies now trying to rebrand their meals as medically tailored meals when they're not, said Mozafarian. It's a problem. It hurts the movement, and more importantly, it hurts the patients. Homestyle Direct's rebrand as a medically tailored meal provider appears to be relatively recent. Archives of the company's website, dating back more than two decades, reveal it began claiming that it was selling medically tailored meals only last year. The company began operating in 1997, and in its early years pitched itself primarily as a meal delivery service for people with busy lives. How many times have you come home at the end of a long day, only to discover that nothing was planned for dinner and you're too tired to make it anyway, the company's homepage asked in 2001. By 2009, Medicaid programs in six states were reimbursing the company for its meals. The number ballooned to 18 in 2018, and now the company is reimbursed in 30 states. With that expansion have come legal troubles. In 2009, Oregon kicked the company out of its Medicaid program because it sent patients frozen meals on a monthly basis. The Oregon's program required meal providers to deliver hot meals on a daily basis. The company unsuccessfully appealed the decision up to the Oregon Supreme Court, arguing that the state unlawfully changed the program rules. In 2015, Homestyle Direct paid $357,000 to settle a federal lawsuit over claims the company billed Medicaid for desserts that were not covered by the program, shipped excess meals to patients to collect Medicaid checks, and even billed Medicaid for meals allegedly provided to patients who, in fact, were deceased. The move into selling medically tailored meals coincided with a large investment in the company by the private equity firm Harkness Capital Partners in 2021. Harkness also invests in a school lunch company, a roofing provider, and a pump rental service company. In a press release announcing the investment, the CEO of Homestyle Direct said that Harkness, quote, provides capital and strategical operational resources at an ideal time to support our rapid growth. Several of the leading food as medicine-focused nonprofits unveiled an accreditation program for medically tailored meal providers earlier this year in hopes of standardizing their quality. Many of Homestyle Direct offerings appear not to meet those standards. For the company, for example, offers fried foods such as fried chicken, which the Food is Medicine's coalition standards consider unacceptable. Those guidelines also suggest that medically tailored meals should typically have between 700 to 800 milligrams of sodium, depending on the condition being treated. Less than half of the meals offered by Homestyle Direct meet that target. Several of the company's meals also contain little or no fiber, which studies have correlated with heart health and reduced the risk of certain forms of cancer and all-cause mortality. Items on Homestyle Direct, quote, heart-friendly menu contain an average of 5 grams of fiber per meal, according to stats analysis. The accreditation standard recommended between 8 to 9 grams of fiber per meal for most diets. Bartow, the CEO, told Stat the company offers, quote, supplemental items for all Medicaid beneficiaries, including oatmeal, or supplemental drinks that offer additional fiber, dairy, and vitamins. Yeah, supplements rather than food. So much for food is medicine. Medicaid accounts for 98% of Homestyle Direct's revenue, according to Bartow, though he won't say how much he takes in from the program, which is jointly funded by states and the federal government. Stat confirmed through public record requests that just 3 states, that is in the millions annually. Oklahoma paid Homestyle Direct $6.2 million in 2023, and Idaho paid the company $1 million that year. South Carolina has paid the company $2.8 million so far this fiscal year. The lax Medicaid standards for nutritional quality are likely a byproduct of how the program that pays for these meals was conceived, argued Landauer, the Harvard professor. It was really more about targeting who may be homebound and in jeopardy of being food insecure, less so on really ensuring adequate access to nutritious food, she said. It's such an important point to be asking this question. Does that still serve us? Is that still where the focus should be? Or we should be striving for more than that? Stat asked several states that contract with Homestyle Direct whether they were concerned that vulnerable patients might purchase the company's meals thinking they are healthy. Officials in several states emphasized that the meals follow the legal standard and that patients are free to choose the meals that fit their lifestyle. Oklahomans who receive home-delivered meals through the waiver program have choices as to who they select as a meal provider and the type of meal they choose, said a spokesman for Oklahoma Human Services, which contracts with Homestyle Direct. Homestyle Direct advertises that it contracts with private Medicare plans. However, those contracts are not subject to public disclosure. Customers can also purchase directly from Homestyle Direct for $9.95 each. That price is often much higher than patients would pay if they just bought the same food at the grocery store. A Jimmy Dean breakfast sandwich, for example, costs $1.37 per sandwich at Walmart, though the Homestyle Direct meal also comes with diced sweet potatoes. Honestly, for some of these patients, they would be better just giving them healthy choice frozen dinner, said Jessica Peters, outpatient nutrition manager at Boston Medical Health Center Health System. Bartow said the higher price for the meals incorporates not just the cost of food, but also the comprehensive service preparing, packaging, and shipping frozen meals directly to recipient stores across multiple states. He said the company utilizes a network of refrigerated long haulers and FedEx hubs to maintain meal quality during shipping. However, when Stat purchased several Homestyle Direct meals last month, the food arrived thawed and unsafe to eat. Bartow said in a statement the company follows state guidance for meal quality, but the issue of warm food being delivered is highly unusual, not representative of our standard service, and due to the fact that the company does not typically serve Massachusetts, where Stat is headquarters. Well, folks, just another cautionary tale that when you introduce the profit motive, it may run counter to the social good that's attempted to be run by any particular program. Okay, well, some of this is just an outgrowth of the fact that our food system is a mess, and this next story gets at some of that from this from food politics. The International Panel of Experts on Sustainable Food Systems has a new report, Food from Somewhere, Building Food Security and Resilience Through Territorial Markets. The report argues that territorial food systems, which is regional food systems, are better able to promote food security than industrial food systems. This is because corporate-controlled global food chains offer a flawed recipe for food security and are full of risks and vulnerabilities, such as the exposure of industrial commodity production to climate shocks, the diversion of valuable resources into ultra-processed foods, livestock feed, and fuel, the standardization of diets around wheat, rice, and corn, and the growing reliance on a handful of crops and commodity exporters for global calorie intake, the bottlenecks in fragmented and geographically dispersed global chains, the vast energy requirements built into high-tech digitalized supply chains, and the dangers of making global food security contingent on just-in-time supply chains that, in fact, do not work all the time. The remedy. We found that territorial markets are the backbone of food systems in many countries and regions and make critical contributions to food security, equity, and sustainability while building resilience on multiple fronts. By territorial, they mean regional, local, close-to-home markets with short supply chains. So basically, we should just have more decentralized food systems rather than relying on a globalized system. Okay, last but not least in the regular reporting, COVID doesn't want to go away. This from Axios, another hot COVID summer. COVID-19 cases are growing or likely growing in 45 states and territories, and more than half of the states have virus levels that are high or very high as summertime waves expands, according to the CDC. Now, I will note that Ohio actually is low at this point. COVID-19 cases have risen in the U.S. every summer, usually around July 4th travel. While hospitalizations remain low, the summertime surge poses a risk to the elderly, immunocompromised individuals, and those with respiratory or cardiac conditions. As people get more out of date with vaccination and the virus mutates, the risk of a severe wave becomes greater. And the CDC does recommend that everyone 6 months old and up receive updated vaccines coming soon to you. Okay, well, that brings us to our last feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and longer reads for increased enrichment, all available, like all the other stories I've reported on, at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll repeat that link again at the end. This week we have 40 bonus stories, so let's get to it. First up, alcohol is driving a half dozen types of cancer in the U.S. That's one of those modifiable risk factors for cancer that reported on earlier. And alcohol, basically, even at low levels of consumption, should basically be considered a carcinogen. Bonus article 2, The Dark Side of Zyn, How Tobacco-Free Nicotine Pouches May Harm Your Health. So nicotine is dangerous in and of itself, and while it offers some advantages over consuming it with tobacco as well, there's also a concern that young people will use this and get addicted to nicotine and then lead to other nicotine delivery devices, including tobacco use. Bonus article 3, should kids be able to buy non-alcoholic beer, wine, and mocktails? A similar issue here is basically marketers teeing up young people for their brands and type of cocktails when they become of age. Bonus article 4, stimulant users caught up in a fatal fourth wave of opioid epidemic. So, methamphetamine and other stimulants are becoming more popular, they're also being contaminated by fentanyl and leading to overdoses. Bonus article 5, everyone deserves addiction treatment that works, including those in jail. The leading cause of death in the time immediately after being released from jail or prison is an overdose. There is an overpopulation, an overrepresentation of people with addiction in prisons, and we should be dealing with that, not just criminalizing it. Bonus article 6, California to finally have indoor heat standards for workplaces. With a cruel exception for prisoners, they've decided not to cover prisoners for this because, of course, it would be too expensive. Can you imagine being in a hot prison with no air conditioning and actually having work to do. Bonus Article 7. Abandoned mines cover the West with a legacy of destruction and pollution of lands and water. So there are thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of abandoned mines in the West, and it leads to a lot of pollution of land and water. Bonus Article 8, pollution knows no borders, as a long-sought agreement will address Canadian mine waste flowing downriver into the U.S. So this is an example of, you know, cross-border, this being an international border. And they're trying to come to an agreement to prevent Canadian toxins coming into the U.S. This is a little ironic since the U.S. Supreme Court just ruled against the Biden administration's EPA of trying to regulate states that are getting pollution from other states. You know, the feds apparently can, you know, regulate interstate commerce, but they can't regulate interstate pollution. So, yes, a continued problem of living together on this planet. Bonus Article 9, the problematic chemicals fueling America's EV revolution, ramped up production of toxins used in batteries, has communities worried. So there's some really bad track records of these chemicals from electric batteries that are used in EVs, electric vehicles, and it's something that's only going to get worse as we ramp up production. Bonus Article 10, bioplastics are inadequately defined, poorly regulated, and potentially toxic. A good overview of that issue. And related to that, 11, curb stupid plastics and stop industry BS. Urgent action to prevent a plastic crisis. The worst of microplastics is yet to come as plastics degrade over decades. So this is going to roll out over generations. Stupid plastic, it most references single-use plastic, which is kind of absurd when you look at the environmental costs of it. Bonus Article 12, how concerned should we be about metals in tampons? So this is a story that I wasn't going to report on because these are relatively small amounts, but this is a really good article that gets at how should we decide what the real risk is something. Is just because there's measurable, detectable amounts of something, it may not actually be that significant. So if you're interested in that issue, great story to read. Bonus Article 13, barrel storm power outages crowd hospitals and delay new admissions. So when the power goes out, they couldn't send people home to hot conditions, and they may have need medical equipment that needs electricity, so they're putting them in a stadium. So it's just showing that climate change can directly affect our healthcare system. And in that regard, for those folks that rely on home medical devices, Bonus Article 14, how to prepare for power outages if your health depends on home medical devices. Bonus Article 15, racial disparities in dementia determined by social factors rather than genetic ancestry. Yet another scientific study that documents that racism is not a real biological thing. There are not genetic differences that would support the idea of race. So the increased levels of dementia that you see in some racial ethnic populations is driven by social factors, not biology. Bonus Article 16, living in poverty due to mental health problems or developing mental health problems because of poverty. It's both. So this is a complicated reinforcing dynamic where people that are poor do have more mental health problems, and people that have mental health problems are more likely to be poor. Complicated. Bonus Article 17, counting the dead in Gaza. Difficult but essential. This is a good read just to kind of get an update, but also the infrastructure for being able to even count people that are dead is getting weaker and weaker as the infrastructure is being destroyed. A hard read. Bonus Article 18, Navy has record high suicide so far this year amid reports of high stress and quality of life issues. So the Navy has some of the most difficult working conditions in the military, and they're seeing record high suicides. The military sees higher suicides than average for folks that age. Bonus Article 19, new research supports social good as a cognitive approach to dealing with highly stressful events. So this is kind of a cognitive behavioral therapy reframing. If you're like a firefighter and you're in a traumatic situation, you know, by framing it that you're doing some good, it can help mitigate some of the traumatic effects. Bonus Article 20, survey shows loneliness haunts over 1 in 5 people worldwide. We are becoming a more and increasingly lonely world. Bonus Article 21, American diets got briefly healthier and more diverse during the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, this is basically because people weren't eating out and they were eating more at home. And when they do that, they eat better, more different foods and healthier foods. And this is kind of a little bit of an example of the fact that you almost have to nuke our entire food system in order to make it healthier. Because if you're living into the way it is normally, it's probably not good for you. Bonus article 22. Study finds daily sugar intake fell by 5 grams per day in kids and 11 grams per day in adults after the UK sugar tax. Just another example that if you put taxes on foods that aren't particularly good for you, it will actually adjust consumption. And while 5 grams and 11 grams a day doesn't sound like a lot, that's actually significant in the total sugar intake. Bonus article 23, blood fat profiles confirm health benefits of replacing butter with high-quality plant oils. I almost have to laugh to even report that. This is a really very high-quality study that proves what we've actually known for decades is, in fact, that eating high-quality plant oils is better than eating butter or a lot of saturated fats. Bonus article 24, do taxpayer subsidies play a role in the obesity epidemic? The short answer is yes. We support a lot of foods that are not particularly good for you. Bonus article 25. New White House strategy backs food rescue efforts, but more is needed to fight hunger and food waste. So it's nice to have a national strategy, but food waste has been moving the wrong direction recently. And if you want to deep dive into global food systems, bonus article 26. Transforming food environments. A global lens on challenges and opportunities for achieving healthy and sustainable diets for all. I'd give that as the read of the week if you're interested in that topic. Bonus article 27, preparing schools for the H5N1 bird flu they're likely to face. So if it doesn't turn out to be H5N1 bird flu, it's basically eventually there's going to be some respiratory pandemic. And unfortunately, schools are pretty much as unprepared as they were for COVID-19. And more on the bird flu, bonus article 28, Finland is offering farm workers bird flu shots. Some experts say the U.S. should too. Just to put a ring for the people that are at high risk, both to control it from going into the human population. Circle the wagons, folks. Bonus article 29. Health officials pitch anonymous bird flu testing. So farmers and farm workers are very reluctant to get tested, so maybe do anonymous testing. One more idea. Bonus article 30. If bird flu sparks a human pandemic, your past immunity could help, particularly older folks. So our immune system is imprinted disproportionately towards the first thing that we're exposed to. And older folks were exposed to flu viruses that are more similar to the current bird flu strains going around. So weirdly, if we get a bird flu pandemic, older folks might actually fare better than younger folks, a little different than what we saw with COVID, and a little counterintuitive since older folks tend to be more health vulnerable. But this, in fact, played out in different pandemics before. Bonus article 31. Bird flu strain in U.S. cow shows minimal air spread in ferret study. So ferrets are considered a good model of human respiratory virus studies. And they tested 4 ferrets that they infected and put them near, but not able to touch another ferret. And one of the 4 got an antibody response. So they obviously were exposed through the air. They're saying minimal because they weren't able to detect virus in the ferret. But any type of respiratory transmission could be very dangerous, and that may mean that we're close to a possibility of jumping to human transmission of the bird flu. 32, bird flu update. As the number of infected dairy herds mount, so does pessimism about driving H5N1 out of cows. I would share that pessimism. I think it's going to be endemic, something we're going to be dealing with a long time. And of course, the longer it's around, the more likely it can move into humans and mutate to get to the point where it can transmit easily between humans. Bonus article 33, long COVID research roundup. If you're interested in long COVID, here's the latest on that. Why? Bonus article 34, why an AI health coach won't solve the world's chronic disease problems. So long story short, Just that information doesn't necessarily drive all the other problems. You can get a lot of information, but it isn't going to necessarily make you follow health advice, for instance, or have access to the proper additional care that you need to deal with it. Bonus Article 35, free medical school tuition unlikely to have a major impact on the U.S. healthcare system. Bloomberg School of Medicine joined the ranks of free tuition for their medical students, but they don't expect that this is actually going to be able to shift much of the problems with our U.S. medical education. Bonus Article 36, safety of generic Viagra and other drugs called into doubt after false data found by the FDA. So an Indian company submitted false data for a whole bunch of drugs, and they're trying to sort that out. Bonus Article 37, first year of Georgia's Medicaid expansion with work enrollment, work requirements enrolls less than 1% of those who would be eligible under the standard Medicaid expansion. Yep, the old 1% solution. And of course, this probably costs more, so it's probably a 0% solution. But the fact that work requirements basically short-circuit what would be the standard Medicaid expansion. They're talking about like 4,000 people they enrolled when you could have 500,000 if you just did standard Medicaid expansion. Bonus Article 38, more than 6 in 10 U.S. adults support protecting access to IVF. So if you want to see that article with poll data on IVF support, excellent. Bonus Article 39, premenstrual dysphoric disorder, PMDD, is a menstrual disorder much more severe than PMS, and it can cause despair and suicide and is very much misunderstood. And last but not least, Bonus Article 40, the Supreme Court's contempt for facts is a betrayal of justice, undermining the role of evidence, expertise, and honesty in American democracy. A good rundown, a litany of where facts don't seem to really matter in the Supreme Court. You can view these and all the other articles by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.